Thank you very much. My name is Ernie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Hey, y'all. A real pleasure to be here. The circumstances I'm here under make me feel very inadequate, and I'm not here to fill in for somebody. I'm not here to substitute for somebody. I'm simply here to try to tell you my story in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May the 2nd, 1982. My sponsor's name is Paul B., and my home group is the Skyland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that's the things I'm supposed to say before I get started. That's what my sponsor tells me anyhow. I was born in Columbus, Georgia on July 31st, 1935. I just celebrated my 70th birthday, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that before the night's over, and I will quit on time, I promise you that too. But I was born to a high school principal and a first grade teacher. My daddy was a principal of the school that I attended for 12 years, and my mama taught the first grade for 44 years. And I can tell you that I don't recommend that to anybody. Needless to say that going to school where your daddy is principal is not good for him, and it certainly wasn't good for me. I spent half my time trying to make good grades and do things to make my parents happy, and the other half my time trying to convince people that I wasn't a whoosh. And that's a difficult line to follow. And eventually what happens is nobody trusts you because you aren't anybody, because you're whatever everybody wants you to be. And they figure that out so nobody trusts you, so you don't have any friends, really. And I went through that, and every time I got a spot on a sports team, it was because my daddy was principal. And anytime anything good happened, it was because my daddy was principal. And then when bad things happened, my daddy was principal, and he made it a point to tell me that he was principal. And that's the way it worked out. So I grew up with a lot of resentments. I resented the fact that my mom and dad were both in education, and it seemed like that everybody that I knew had a lot more than we had. I grew up an only child, and I very much resented the fact that I was an only child, because all the kids that I knew that had brothers and sisters had people they could talk to, and it made it a little bit easier, it seemed to me like. I resented the fact that every time they opened the doors at the Winton Road Baptist Church, Mama had me in there. I was deathly afraid of God. I was deathly afraid of my daddy. And the third thing that I was deathly afraid of was girls, as you'll see as my story goes on. It was not a pretty picture. With all those resentments, obviously, I wasn't a very nice person to be around. So I grew up in that atmosphere. And I went off to the University of Georgia, a very immature young man. I went off to the University of Georgia. I'd never been up past 12 o'clock a night in my life. I had never spent the night anywhere except my grandparents' house, my aunts or my uncles or whatever. I'd never spent a night away from home before I went off. Needless to say, when I got there, they saw me as what I was, and that was a nerd. I didn't like that. I didn't like that, but I accepted that. I did pledge a fraternity, and I was I somehow passed the black balls and got into the fraternity, and I felt that that was a big thing. I lived with two other guys that were very much like me in the fraternity house in a room that they called Virgin Villa, and you can guess why they called it that. I had not had a drink until I was in my second quarter junior year at the University of Georgia. I forgot to tell you that my dad, in my opinion, that's all I can tell you, it's an opinion, my dad was a closet alcoholic. He was the principal of the school, he was the president of the Civitan Club, he was all the things that you're supposed to be in the community. But when daddy came home, there were always some bottles of Gilbert's Distilled London Dry Gin somewhere around the house, and daddy drinking it out of the original container. And I know that after 7:30 at my house, you needed to be either in bed or someplace else, because the whole atmosphere changed at my house at 7:30. So that's why I was afraid of him. So between God and daddy and girls, I had a heck of a life when I got up there. I hurt my leg playing intramural ball when I was a junior at the University of Georgia, and they put my leg in a cast, and I came downstairs one morning at the fraternity house, and one of my fraternity brothers looked at me and said, "Big E, why don't we go to Harry's and get a beer?" And laughed, and everybody laughed, and I thought, okay, why don't we? And so they took me out to Harris and Little Five Points in Athens, and they say that I drank six tall Budweisers. If I did, I don't remember it, but they say I drank six tall Budweisers. Well, I know is it got the job done. All I know is that N I had on my chest turned into S, and I became Superman. And my fraternity brothers, being the nice people that they were, they decided that they would take me around to the sorority houses and show me off. The university wasn't nearly as big back then as it is now. And we went around to the sorority houses, and they say that I went upstairs in the sorority houses. Well, back in those days, you didn't go upstairs in the sorority houses. And they say that I brought some ladies' underthings downstairs in the sorority house. Now, I don't know whether I did or not, but if I did, it was the first time I'd ever seen any up close and personal. I can tell you that. I knew exactly what page they were on in the Sears and Roebuck catalog, but I had never seen any up close and personal. That was Playboy back in my era. Well, to make a long story short, they took me back to the house, and I went through the same process I went through many times thereafter. I got deathly ill, and I passed out, and I woke up the next morning, and I knew three things were going to happen. I knew God was going to get me, and I knew Daddy was going to get me. And one of my fraternity brothers came in and revealed something to me for the very first time. He said, "Big E, you feel rotten, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I sure do." He said, "You know the only way to get to feeling better?" I said, "How is that?" He said, "You need a little vodka and orange juice." I said, "Well, pour me one." And he did, and I had my first morning drink after my first drink ever. And I kind of thought that was the way you're supposed to do it. Shortly after that, I went downstairs in the fraternity house and the telephone rang. And it was a big event, because somebody had called me, and it wasn't my mama and it wasn't my daddy. It was one of the little girls at one of the sorority houses we'd been at the night before. I picked up the phone, and it was the head majorette. And she said, "Ernie, where's all that personality been?" And I thought to myself, "Well, look up here." I knew where that personality was. And so I made sure I had personality with me at all times after that. I asked her for a date. She dated me, and we dated for about 2 months. I gave her my fraternity pin. We dated for a couple more months, and I got to being afraid that she might catch me sober and find out what I was really like. I asked her to marry me, and she made one of the two worst mistakes she ever made in her life. She said yes. And so we got married in first quarter of our senior year at the University of Georgia. She was a beautiful girl. She was a smart girl. She's a wonderful woman. Wonderful woman. And we got married, and something happened. A week before the ceremony, I was at home, and we were planning everything for the next week. And my daddy was out mowing the lawn, and I'd re-injured my leg, and I had it back in a cast. And daddy was outside mowing the lawn, and he had a heart attack. And he passed away. And I'll never forget that day, because first of all, I felt guilty, because if I hadn't had the cast on my leg, I'd have been out more than long. The second thing you need to know is what we found out there right beside him was a half-filled bottle of Gilbert's Distilled London Dry Gin. And so he was out there drinking out of the original container in about 95-degree heat, and passed away at 55 years of age. I wish I could tell you that I felt sorry that a son should feel for his father when that happened. But you see, my daddy had planned everything in my life up until that time. My daddy decided what classes I was going to take, where I was going to go to school, what classes I was going to take at school, all of these things he had planned for me. And I felt much like Martin Luther King standing on the mountaintop. I thought, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. And I took charge of my life that day. And over the next 27 years, I made the biggest mess out of it that you can imagine. But I called my spouse-to-be, and she said, "We'll go ahead with the ceremony." And I said, "Fine." So that was the first omen that God sent her. The second omen was that my leg was in a cast, and the doctor said he'd take it out of the cast the day of the ceremony, and then I had to go back to his office after the ceremony was over, and he put it back in a cast. That was the second omen that he sent her. And she still said she wanted to marry me. The third omen that he sent her was that she woke up the morning of our wedding with the mumps. So she decided we would go ahead with the wedding. So we walked down the aisle together, and it looked kind of like Chester and Hootie and the Blowfish. And of course, as soon as the wedding was over, she went back home and went to bed, and I went to the doctor's office and got the cast put her back on. And I spent the night at a Georgia Tech dormitory with my best man. And so my first night of marriage was just like every other night in my life. But we managed to get through that, and we came to Atlanta, and we moved in with her mom and dad until we could find a place to live. And I got a job 7 days after I got here with a company that I retired and rehired. I've worked for 48 years, take away 3 months. But I got a job with that company, and it wasn't good living in her mom and daddy's house because I was drinking pretty regular. And the place where I went to work, it was kind of average thing was to go across the street to a place kind of ironically called Harris and drink a couple of beers for lunch, six maybe or seven. And that's the way we got started. Then we moved into a little house, and I continued to drink. And the more I drank, the more I began to do other things that drunks have a tendency to do. If you're out drinking every night and you're in places where there are other ladies, you have a tendency to be attracted to some of the other ladies. And I began to do those things. And she knew what I was doing, but, you know, alcoholism is a family disease. And she decided if we had a baby, things would get better. So we had a beautiful baby girl. We had a labor party out on my patio the day that she was going into the hospital. And I passed out, and she went to the hospital and had the baby, and I showed up the next day, and I was not welcome when I got there. Her mom and daddy were there, and a lot of people were there, and I was not welcome. But, as I say, it's a family disease. So shortly thereafter, she decided if we had another baby, things would get better. So we had another beautiful little girl, and things got worse. By this time, if you're out doing these kind of things, then eventually you're going to run into somebody that's going to talk you into, you know, what you need to do is leave that situation you're in, and you and I will get married and live happily ever after. And when you're drinking that old liquor, it makes it sound like a pretty good idea. And I'll never forget, that one little girl was 5 years old, and the other little girl was 3 years old. And I went over one night, and I picked up my stuff and drove away in a 66 Mustang. And that little five-year-old girl stood at the door with her hands against the door with tears in her eyes and begged me not to leave. Drunk, I still cried, but I left. And I went out to that old 66 Mustang, and I reached down under that seat, and I took out that old vodka bottle, and I took about three chugs off of it. And it did what it used to do for me. It made all that guilt go away. It made all that bad feeling go away. It made everything okay. It did that for a period of time before it stopped doing that. And I left that beautiful girl and those two beautiful little children that I had in that house, and I went with this other lady. And we got married. And it was not a marriage made in heaven. Her mama paid for the honeymoon because a self-respecting drunk with a family and alimony and child support payments can't afford a honeymoon. So her mama paid for the honeymoon. We went to Florida on the honeymoon. The night we came back, I had a date with another little girl. So obviously it wasn't a marriage made in heaven. So that second marriage started out just like the first. And the only thing I'll say about it is that she liked to drink liquor and run the streets, and I liked to drink liquor and run the streets, and we just tried to work different streets so we wouldn't run into each other. You know, that was kind of the way it was. One day at my office, the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen walked in, and I thought to myself, boy, that is one wonderful, beautiful woman. If I could make that woman my wife, everything would be okay. Well, but two things wrong. I was still married to number two, and she was married, and she was pregnant. So at the Christmas party that year, I was dancing with her, and I told her I thought I was in love with her. She hit me so hard that the nurse had to come take care of me for about 5 minutes and told me I was the craziest so-and-so she had ever met. I took that as a challenge. Some 7.5 to 8 months later, I had convinced her that if we got married, everything would be wonderful. So she left her husband, and I left my second wife. And she was pregnant, and she had the little boy. And I believed that the little boy was going to make everything all right, because then I'd have a little boy to go hunting and play sports with and take the ball games and do all those wonderful things, and that things would be different. I really believed that. But then she says... I used to say it was 3 weeks. She said it was 6 days. 6 days after we got married, I went by my favorite watering hole, and I had one drink. That's all I had that day, one drink. But then I went the next day and I had 2 drinks. And the next day, and the next day. And within a month, I was right back doing the very same thing I'd been doing before. Now, I still love this woman with all my heart. But I had gotten into this thing, and that's just what I was doing. She put up with that for 9 long years. 9 years. We went to Kentucky Derby in 1982 because her mother lived up there. And Granny had somehow gotten us tickets in the clubhouse on the finish line at the Derby, and Kenny Rogers was sitting over there, and the governor of Kentucky was sitting over there, and you know, a drunk, I thought I was somebody. And I had made an agreement with her that when we got back to Atlanta, I'd go into the drunk hospital, that I would go in the drunk hospital. And the reason I'd agreed to that, because she'd made it perfectly clear that I had 2 choices. One was to go in the drunk hospital, and one was to get the heck out of there. So I decided I'd do that. Well, the deal was I could have 3 drinks during the Derby. Well, there are 10 races on Derby Day. And I was so nice that I volunteered to take everybody's bets to the windows. And there was a bar right outside the clubhouse. And I had made up with a bartender. Every time I come out between races, pour me 3 shots of vodka in a glass. And he did. And so in 10 races, I had 30 drinks, plus I had my 3 drinks at the table. And everybody's trying to figure out how in the world I got so drunk off of 3 drinks. But we went over to her sister's house that night for a Derby party. And approximately, they say 15 minutes after we got in the house, I passed out. I had on a lovely blue leisure suit. And she was having spaghetti and Chianti. And they have a picture of me laying on the floor with spaghetti and Chianti from here to here. And they put a coffee table over me so people wouldn't step on me. And they get that out from time to time as a reminder of what it used to be like. So the next day we started home, and of course I was getting an earful because by that time they had figured out that there was something rotten in Denmark. So I was getting an earful, so I stopped in Chattanooga. And I turned the driving over to her, and I took a 1/2 gallon of old Mr. Boston vodka, and I did my best to drink as much of it as I could, because I figured if I'm going in the drunk hospital, I'm going to be qualified when I get there. And I woke up the next morning in the drunk hospital. There I was. I kind of peeped down the hall, and I think I see a familiar face. I walk down the hall, and I walk up to this guy, and I say, "Are you who I think you are?" He says, "I am if you're who I think you are." It turned out it was my second wife's second husband. Well, they thought we were going to get in all kinds of trouble, but we got to be best friends. We decided she had driven us both to drink. And we spent 28 days taking her inventory. And one old boy's in there, old Bob. Old Bob made it up. They called us husbands-in-law. I was the only person that ever at Peaceford Hospital that had a wife and an ex-wife in a family meeting on Wednesday night. That was not a good circumstance. But so before I went in the hospital, I forgot to tell you, one of the friends of mine I used to travel with, and we were best of friends. We lived in the condominiums together. We lived approximately 100 yards apart. He got sober 3 years prior to the time that I went into the drunk hospital. We got sober 3 years apart, and I chose not to speak to him for 3 years, and we'd been the best of friends. I mean, we'd run the streets and drank together and done all kinds of things together. And I chose not to speak to him. And about 3 weeks before I was going in, I didn't know at the time that I was going in, I was going to stay sober one Sunday morning. I wasn't drinking. And Mama had asked me to fix a gate on the back of the condo. And I was back there, and I was trying to put a screwdriver on a screw. Now, drunk that hadn't had a drink today, trying to put a screwdriver on a screw was not working out real well. And my friend John came by, and for the first time in 3 years, we spoke. "How you doing, Ernie?" "Well, I'm not doing too well." "Are you having trouble?" "Yes, sir, I am." "Well, can I help you?" "You sure can." Well, he fixed my gate, okay? He was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He did exactly what you're supposed to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't talk to me about AA. He didn't talk to me about my drinking. All he did was simply say, "If you need me, you know where I am." And he walked away. And he went back to his condo and he told his lovely wife, Helen, "It won't be long now." And 3 weeks later, I was in the drunk hospital. And, of course, who came over there? John. Who appointed himself as my sponsor? John. And then there was Joe H. And any of y'all that knew Joe H., I mean, he took me on as a special project, and I'm grateful that he did, but I hated it at the time. And the first words he ever said to me was standing in my door, and he looked at me. He weighed about 135 pounds, soaking wet, I guess. And he says, "I can tell by looking at you that you think you're somebody, but let me be the first to tell you, you ain't. You guess the rest, okay?" That was the first words, and that was the nicest thing he ever said to me. But he stayed on my case, and I'm glad he did. And so I got out of the hospital and started working with John, but John wasn't real tough on me. I'd done a little four-step in the hospital, you know, the little thing you go through, and it wasn't very much. And John kind of let me get by with that. And for 3 years, John sponsored me, and I didn't drink, but I wasn't doing anything that I was supposed to be doing. Not a thing that I was supposed to be doing. I wasn't drinking, but I was doing a lot of other things I didn't have any business doing. I was traveling, and I was doing all kinds of stuff. And John was kind of letting me slide by with that, and I loved John to death. But John died after 3 years and passed away. And I got mad as the dickens at God because John had passed away, because, see, John was letting me slide. And I appreciated John. I loved John, and God took him away. And I knew something was going to happen, and sure enough, it did. Many of y'all probably knew Dennis S. I don't know if you knew Dennis or not, but Dennis had a record of killing a man in California with his bare hands, and I knew that. And shortly after John passed away, I was kind of rocking along without a sponsor. And we were having a step meeting at Skyland one night, and it was on the fourth step. And as I always did when we got to the fourth step, I always said, "You know, I really need to do another fourth step. And you know something I can't understand? I've been in this program 3 years, and I ain't got any pigeons. I don't know why I don't have any pigeons." Well, when that meeting was over, I walked out into the big room at Skyland under the clock, and Dennis picked me up off the floor and put me against the wall. He said, "I got two things for you." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "The first thing is you will meet me in the parking lot at 9 o'clock Saturday morning, and you will have done a fourth step, and we're going to do a fifth step." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "The second thing is the reason why you ain't got any pigeons is because they don't want what you got." I said, "Yes, sir." So I met him on that Saturday morning. We went over to a little parking lot, and it was very secluded, and got in the shade of a tree and got out of the car and got down on our knees and did the third step prayer. And I didn't tell y'all, but I was a journalism major at the University of Georgia, and I had a wonderful four step put together. It was about like that. And we got back in the car and opened the doors on both sides, and I started reading. I think I might have gotten 2 minutes, maybe one and a half. And Dennis said, "Pardon me while I puke." I said, "Sir?" He said, "Have you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You didn't read it too good." He said, "You go back and you read the fourth step and the fifth step. We'll meet next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, same time, same place, and you do it the way the book says this time." I said, "Yes, sir." And I met him the next Saturday morning. We got out on our knees again. We did the third step prayer. And I tried my best to do a fourth and a fifth step that day as well as I possibly could. And when it was all over, Dennis told me three things that I'll never forget. The first thing he told me was, "You and your mama don't have a good relationship, do you?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "You know why?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Because she loves you more than you love her. And what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to prove to her how much you love her. Once a week, you're going to have to send her candy or flowers or a card or something once a week. You understand that?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "The other thing, you're going to have to go down and see her once a month and take her to lunch on the weekend." I said, "Yes, sir." And I started doing that. Second thing he told me, he said, "You stole all that money from that company you've been working for, didn't you?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did. I stole a lot of money." He said, "You got no idea how much you stole, do you?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Beginning this month, every month when you fill out your expense report, you tear up $100 worth of expenses. If your family's not going hungry, you tear up $100 worth of expenses and you throw them away. And if you work there for about 1,000 years, you may be able to pay that money back." But he said, "Making amends is not saying I'm sorry. Making amends is making amends. And that's what you need to do." I said, "Yes." And I started doing that. The third thing that he told me that day was, "You know all those things you talked to me about?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Everything that you talked to me about today, let the last time be the last time." Oh, my goodness. That was a heaven. But I can tell you tonight that the things we talked about that day, the last time, was the last time. I'm not telling you that I've been living at the foot of the cross for the last 23 years or 20 years, but I am telling you that the last time was the last time for the things we talked about that day. I can tell you that I've torn up $100 worth of receipts ever since I've been there. Of course, I retired for about 3 months, and they rehired me and brought me back. And you know I had to go ask him if I still had to tear up that $100 worth of receipts. And he looked at me, and I knew what the answer was. He didn't have to say anything. Well, you know, 5 years later, my mama passed away. And I'll never forget it, because I went down and did everything I had to do. And I got to tell you a little story about that. Mama was a devout Baptist. She was at the Winter Road Baptist Church every time the doors opened. She died in a Catholic hospital. They called me down there, and they told me that what I saw was what I'd get. She may last 2 hours, 2 days, two weeks, 2 months, and I'm the only child, and I'm the only living relative she's got, and you're going to have to make the decision. Well, I sure didn't want to do that. So I went down to the chapel in the Catholic hospital, and I'm down in the chapel and got my head down and trying to do the best I can to talk to the God of my understanding. I feel a hand on my shoulder, and I look up, and it's a Catholic priest. He said, "Are you having a bad day, son?" I said, "Yes, sir, I sure am." He said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Sir, I don't know whether you can help me or not, because, see, I'm not a Catholic. I was born a Baptist, but I guess today you'd have to say I'm kind of AA." And he looked at me, and he said, "Son, I'm a friend of Bill's, too." And he said, "Let's talk about it." And we did. I don't believe that was a coincidence. And we talked about it, and then we got down on our knees and prayed, and we got up, and he said, "What'd you hear?" And I said, "I heard that if it was me, I'd wanted to go ahead and get this over with." He said, "That's what I heard, too." So I went upstairs and told him. And then I left that hospital after she passed away, and we made all the arrangements and had the funeral and did all that. And then I went back, and it was Friday night. And Dennis was at that meeting, and I walked up to him and hugged his neck and thanked him for the fact that I had had an opportunity to rebuild a relationship with my mama because of what he had done for me. I will never forget that. So there I was, and I was working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started scheduling my road trips on the meetings I like to go to. I started everything I scheduled because I found meetings that I like to go to. I had a home away from home group in Greer, South Carolina. That was the first meeting I went to after I got out of the hospital. My sponsor called up there and got Squire Jones. Squire's gone on to the other room now, but he was a grand old man of AA in Greenville, South Carolina. And so he told me to call Squire when I got to Greenville. I got to Greenville, I called Squire, and he said, "Son, how long you been sober?" I said, 93 days or something like that. He said, "Well, son, where are you?" I said, "I'm in the Regency over here." He said, "Son, 93 days. I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Do you think you can find the lobby?" I said, "Yes, sir, I think I can find the lobby." And he picked me up and he took me into a little room over in Greer. It was the church with the red door. That's the way they called the meeting, the church with the red door. And that was my home away from home group. And I just happened to be there on my first AA birthday. It was a coincidence, but I just happened to be there on my first AA birthday. And they said, "You're going in the newcomers meeting tonight." I said, "Newcomers meeting? I got a year. You know, what do you mean I got to go in the newcomers meeting?" I said, "Yeah, okay." So I went in the newcomers meeting. When I came out, they had ordered a cake, and we had a little first birthday party for me at my home away from home group. And that's the kind of thing that happened in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are the wonderful things that have happened to me. Over the years, there have been so many coincidences and so many wonderful things. A little girl of mine, see, Mom and I had a little girl. She had a boy, and then we had a little girl. My little girl was 3 years old when I got sober. I'd like to think today that she's 26 and I'm 23, and we grew up together. We got a chance to grow up together. She'll always be 3 years older than I am. She's more mature than I am, you know. But we grew up together. What a wonderful thing to grow up with a child. Because she was a child, and I was a child, and we were kind of feeling our way together. Did I spoil her? I spoiled her rotten. And it sure cost me a lot of money last September when she got married, I'll tell you that. But I will always be grateful that I have that child. That boy that I was going to do all those things with, I didn't do anything. Didn't do a thing. You know, I was too busy. Drunks are too busy to do things with their kids. Drunks are too busy to do anything worthwhile. We got too many irons in the fire. We got too much stuff going on. We're big shots. We got to do those kind of things. That young man has grown up to be such a wonderful man. Yeah, he's been through a marriage and a divorce, but I understand that. But he recently graduated with a master's degree from Duke University. He went on the weekends, and I went up there, and I saw him graduate, and I cried. I cry a lot these days. One thing I found out, it's okay for a man to cry. And I cried, because he did that on weekends and got his master's degree on weekends. And I'm so proud of him. And he found a little girl that he was dating when he was in high school. And they're getting married on September the 17th. And she's got a doctor's degree from North Carolina. I say, well, y'all may not ever make any money, but y'all sure are well educated. I'll tell you that. But I'm looking forward to that. Because you see that little boy got on his bicycle. Little boy got on his bicycle and rode over to Peaceford Hospital to see me when I was in the hospital. Of course, they wouldn't let him in. But he came to see me. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that boy doing it. I'm going to be the best man in his wedding on the 17th. I'm looking forward to that. He gave me a watch and said, Dad, you'll always be my best man. And I'm telling you, that's the wonderful things in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those two little girls that I told you about, one standing with her arms across the door. The company that I went back to work for, they called me a consultant. You know I can't spell it, and I know I can't spell it, but if you won't tell, I won't tell, okay? But I went back to, and the first assignment they gave me, they wanted me to go down and work in a division down in Tampa, Florida. And guess who lives in Tampa, Florida? The youngest of those two little girls by their first marriage. And I got an opportunity to spend 14 months in a residence inn, except for, you know, coming back from meetings and various and sundry things, in Tampa, Florida. And I got to reestablish a relationship with my second daughter and two of my wonderful grandchildren and her husband. And we got to talk and go out to eat, and I got to watch them play ball, and I got to do all those things that a granddaddy and a daddy is supposed to do. See, I choose not to believe that that was a coincidence. I think God made that possible so I could build that relationship. I came back to Atlanta, was in Atlanta about 3 months, and guess what? They sent me to Cincinnati, Ohio for 13 months because they had another problem up there. Guess who lives in Cincinnati, Ohio? That oldest little girl and two grandchildren and her husband. And I got to see all of them play ball and play soccer and play basketball, and I got to spend time with my oldest baby girl, and I got to go to church with them, you know. And I got to do all the things that a granddaddy's supposed to do. I don't think that was a coincidence. I think God was being a whole lot better to me than I ever deserved. When people ask me how I'm doing, I say, better than I deserve. That happened at where I worked not too long ago. Somebody said, how you doing, Ernie? I said, better than I deserve. And there was a new little girl there, hadn't been there very long. She said, Ernie, you don't mean that. One of the old timers back in the back said, baby, if you only knew. But all those things have happened because of the God-given program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Dennis S., many of you probably knew Dennis. Dennis passed away last year. I'm driving to Skyland on a Tuesday night. And I normally don't stop at Starbucks when I'm going to Skyland. I stop at Starbucks on Thursday nights and Saturday nights when I'm going to the Winter Circle, but I don't stop when I'm going to Skyland. But I thought, I'm going to stop at Starbucks and get me a cup of coffee. I stopped at Starbucks on Tuesday night. I walked out with my coffee in my hand, and guess who was standing there? Dennis S. I hugged his neck. I said, Dennis, you know how much I love you, and thank you so much for what you did for me. And I will never forget the fact that you turned my life around. And I hugged his neck again and told him how much I loved him. And I got in the car, and I drove home. I drove to Scotland. When I woke up Wednesday morning, there was a message on my telephone. Dennis S. had passed away. I don't believe that was a coincidence. I think God gave me an opportunity to tell Dennis how much I loved him one more time before he went on to the other room. I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for all of the things that God gives me today. I'm so grateful that I'm able today to want what I have more than have what I want. That makes me feel so good for things like that to happen. All of my children love me today. My birthday was July the 31st. On July the 5th, I went home. I'd been out on the road, and I came in, and Mama says, you know, Rebbe's getting married in September. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, we're having a shower tomorrow night. And I said, oh, that's great. She said, oh, no, you don't understand. It's a couple shower. I said, a couple shower? What in the world is a couple shower? What do men do at a couple's shower? You know, and I'm just raising his hand. And she said, well, we're going. And you know, if there's anything I've learned two magic words in being married to her 33 years. Yes, dear. Yes, dear. So anybody listen to me, I fussed all day Saturday. Went out and played golf, and I talked. Oh, I fussed all day about the couple shower. Went home, got cleaned up, got in the car, went over to the couple shower. Guess what? It was a surprise birthday party for my 70th birthday. My daughter, her husband, and three grandkids from Ohio had driven to Atlanta that day for my birthday party. My daughter and husband and two grandkids from Tampa, Florida had driven to Atlanta that day for my birthday party. My son and his bride-to-be and my grandson from Raleigh, North Carolina drove to Atlanta that day to be at my birthday party. My baby girl had flown in with her husband from Dallas, Texas to be at my birthday party. The president of the company that I work for had flown from New York City to be there for my 70th birthday party. All of these people, plus my nighttime friends were there. All of them were there. What a wonderful party. What a wonderful thing. I will never forget it. I can promise you, and I know it sounds like a cliche, that I felt a lot like Lou Gehrig that night. That night I felt like I was the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Every one of my kids got the microphone. We had a DJ. Every one of my friends got the, every one of my kids got the microphone. And every one of them said the most loving, wonderful things to me that night that I shall never forget. And it was so much more than I deserved. Especially those two little girls that I left standing with their hands across the door. They said such wonderful things that night. And all of my kids and all of my nighttime friends got up and said a few words. And Mama said a few words. And I had to be the most fortunate, grateful man has ever been on earth that night. Those are the kind of things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a wonderful thing for my nighttime friends to see. If we stay with this thing, if we do the things that we're supposed to do, this is what happens. These are the wonderful things that happen. It's got nothing to do with how much money you got in the bank. It's got nothing to do with what kind of house you live in, what kind of car you drive. It's got to do with the miracles that happen in your life because of the God-given program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So wonderful. So on. Now I think about it. There's some of you here tonight that wonder if you're in the right place. There's a couple of you out there. I know you are. I've been there. You wonder, is this a waste of my time? That old man up there talking, hell, he's so old he don't know what he's talking about. You know. But I'm reminded of the story, and it's about the old boy that fell down in the pit. It was a 15-foot pit, and it was steep sides on all four sides. And there was no way out. And he was just sitting there trying to figure out what he was going to do. And a preacher came by. Mr. Preacher, could you help me get out of this pit? The preacher dropped him a New Testament down in the pit and walked away. Well, I'm not telling you, if the man going to find me dead in the bottom of the pit, I'd like to have the New Testament in my hand. Not saying that, but it didn't help him get out of the pit. I was a doctor. Mr. Doctor, can you help me get out of this pit? The doctor wrote him a prescription. Dropped it down in the pit, walked away. Old boy getting a little frustrated by now, you know. Finally, just a regular old boy walks by. Sir, could you help me out of this pit? He was flabbergasted with what the boy did. Jumped down in the pit with him. What are you thinking? Have you lost your mind? Now we're both down here. Old boy turns to him and says, yeah, but I know the way out. I've been here before. There are people here in the audience, if you're thinking that you might be in the wrong place tonight, there are people here in the audience that have been there before. They know the way out. If you'll just talk to them, they'll help you get out of that situation. And I'll close with my son and I went to see a movie called A Field of Dreams. How many of you have seen A Field of Dreams? Wonderful movie, isn't it? Great movie. You know, Kevin Costner's a great actor, I think. What a wonderful movie. And to kind of refresh you, you know, it's about he grew up in a broken home, and his daddy was a major league baseball player, and his daddy and his mama got a divorce, and he didn't know his daddy after that, and he grew up, and he got married, and he had children, and they moved out on a farm out in the Midwest someplace, a corn farm, and everything seemed to be going pretty well, and then all of a sudden he started having these dreams. And his dreams were, build it and they will come. Build it and they will come. He couldn't figure out what in the world this was all about. So finally, one night, he had the solution. What he was supposed to build was a baseball field. So in the middle of a cornfield, he builds this beautiful baseball field. He builds the whole works. He's got lights, he's got bleachers, he's got bases, he's got base paths, he's got everything. Just a beautiful baseball field. And sure enough, the night he turns the lights on for the very first time, all these old baseball players start coming out of the cornfield. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Shoeless Joe Jackson, and of course you know, his dad comes out. And he walks up to his dad and he says to his dad, "Daddy, where you been?" And his daddy said, "Son, I've been to heaven." He said, "Well, tell me, Daddy, what's it like?" He said, "Son, it's a place where dreams come true." Well, I looked down at my old boy, and he was an airborne ranger at the time, beach pressing about 465 pounds. And he was crying, and I sure was proud because I was squalling. And I put my arm around him, and we got out of the movie. I said, "Son, let's go get a cup of coffee." And we got a cup of coffee. And I told him how much I loved him, and he told me how much he loved me. And I said, "Son, you know what? I wish I could see my daddy one more time." And he says, "Why is that?" I said, "Well, boy, if I could see daddy one more time, I can imagine him walking up to me and he'd say, son, I understand you're not drinking anymore." And I said, "Well, daddy, I'm not drinking today, one day at a time." And he'd say, "Well, son, tell me, how'd you do it?" And I'd say, "Daddy, I found a group of people called Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Well, son, what's it like?" And I'd say, "Daddy, it's a place where dreams come true. Yours can too. Thank you very much."